advantages that somebody would have if they were deaf. Any ideas?
We won't be able to hear.
Yeah, won't be able to hear and communicate. That would be a big part of it, wouldn't it? So somebody could come and talk to you, and you just wouldn't be able to make out what it was. Maybe sometimes people can try and read your lips, can't they? People who are deaf can sometimes get quite experienced in that. But it must be as well very isolated. Just imagine sitting there with your hands over your ears, but for day after day after day, and no one can sort of connect with you, can they? You're kind of on your own, in your own little bubble, and you can't hear anyone else. It must be terribly isolating, mustn't it? To feel quite alone, that there's loads of other people out there, but they can't communicate with you. Wow, what would it be like? You can see all these people, but they seem so far away. Someone would come up to you and chat to you, but you wouldn't have a clue what they said. Someone could tell you a joke and you wouldn't know it was funny. Someone could invite you to dinner and you wouldn't go because you didn't know. All of these things you just have not the foggiest idea about. Someone could warn you that there's a fire. And unless they physically grabbed hold of you, you wouldn't even know the danger, would you? Because somebody was telling you the problem and you don't know it. And perhaps people would react to you in funny ways as well. Maybe if you just couldn't hear anything and people are talking to you and you don't respond, well, sometimes people might be quite rude about that, mightn't they? They might think you're stupid. They might think, oh, what's this idiot over here? You know, I'm talking to him, but he's just ignoring me. He's being rude. he just walks away. And sometimes people with disabilities get very sort of insulted by others, don't they? And people can be very unkind. Because, you know, somebody who's deaf seems so cut off. Well, that was a bad enough problem, wasn't it, for this man? But it was only one of his problems. He had a second problem too. He couldn't speak. It says in the verses, kind of later on, that his tongue was loosed. So maybe before the miracle, his tongue was stuck. Yeah, imagine if you don't move your tongue. If your tongue couldn't move at all, how would you make a sound? If you put your hand over your mouth and... You can still make some noises with your voice box, even with your mouth closed and your tongue not moving. You can make some noises, but they become very indistinct, don't they? Because your tongue is what you need to make quite careful sounds with it, doesn't it? Your tongue and your lips work together to make very clever sounds. And again, there's another part of the human body that's amazing, isn't it? How your lips and your tongue and your voice box all work together to produce sounds. Quite amazing. And that's what babies learn to do, isn't it? They first start making funny noises, don't they? Goo goo gaga and all that. And they make these funny sounds as the brain is sort of working out what it does, how to make these different noises. And then babies start to learn little words and then string lots of bits and bobs together and things like that, don't they? That's an amazing thing that God does in doing that. But imagine this man then. We don't know whether he was born like this or whether some sort of accident or illness made this happen to him later on in life. We don't really know, but he's unable to speak. Can you imagine? Being unable to speak to anyone. What would that be like? You can't tell anyone your name. You can't tell them what you need or what you want. You can go to the greengrocers and you can try and gesture at things and what you want, but it might go wrong, mightn't you? How would you go to school if you couldn't speak? How would you have a job? How would you communicate with other people in your family? And so on. This poor man, he couldn't hear and he couldn't speak. And so we read in these verses that there are a crowd of people and they bring to Jesus this man who's deaf and he couldn't speak. And then Jesus, we're told, took him to one side. That's very kind of Jesus, isn't it? And this man perhaps would have hated being the centre of attention, you know. Everyone's looking at him, everyone's brought him to Jesus and there's crowds of people there. And he's this man who feels so isolated. Perhaps he's always been insulted and mistreated by people as well because of his disability. So Jesus takes him away, perhaps guiding him by the hand to one side. And then, what did Jesus do? Let me read a couple of verses, and you can see what happens. So Jesus took him aside from the crowd, put his fingers in his ears, and spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. That is some weird things to do, isn't it, for Jesus? There's some pretty strange miracles of Jesus from time to time in which he does some unusual things, but this is probably one of the most unusual. Can you imagine this man? He can't hear and he can't speak. And then what are the things that happen to him? What does Jesus do? He comes up to him, that's right, and puts his fingers in his ears. Probably gently, just puts his fingers in his ears. Can you imagine if somebody else did that to you? Ooh, be weird, wouldn't it? Somebody to put their fingers in your ears. Then Jesus spits. Maybe he spits on his hand, it's hard to say, because then he touches the man's tongue. That's a bit personal, isn't it? Not very often do people touch our tongue. Maybe just the dentist, really. He's probably the only person on a routine basis, isn't it? Normally he tries to get it out of the way, doesn't he, with that funny little sort of stick. He sort of pushes your tongue down or tries to, it's in a bit in the way then when he's trying to look at your teeth, isn't it? But he's probably the only person who ever puts his fingers in your mouth, isn't he? No one else does apart from the dentist. Well, Jesus does. Jesus spits on his hand and then puts his hand in the man's mouth and touches his tongue. Then what did Jesus do? He looked up to heaven and he sighed and then he spoke to the man. Well, Jesus is kind of doing some very simple sign language, isn't he? This is a very unusual miracle because Jesus does quite so many gestures. But why does he do so many gestures? Because the man can't speak and the man can't hear. So Jesus is actually kind of doing some very sort of simple sign language to the man. This man who's completely isolated, Jesus walks up to him and does this. He's with this touch, is gesturing to this man, I'm going to fix this. You know your ears, you know, that's the problem, I'll fix it. And Jesus then touches his tongue, says, I'll fix that too. You know the problem you've got, I'm going to fix that. I understand what your problem is, I can see what the matter is. And I'm going to deal with that, and I'm going to deal with that. There's Jesus in his gestures, showing this man what he's going to do. And then Jesus looks up to heaven. Again, this man can't hear anything, so Jesus does these symbols to him, gestures to him, and looks up to heaven. He's gesturing to the man that God is going to fix this. It's not some magic trick. It's not some witchcraft or some crazy doctor who thinks he's got the hang of this. No. God is going to do this. He looks up to heaven. God is going to do this in just a minute. And then Jesus sighs. Well, the man couldn't hear the sigh, but you do have a sort of gesture as you sigh, don't you? You sort of have a little shrug of your shoulders and a little dip, and often a little movement of your hands. Jesus sighs. So even if the man couldn't hear, he could see the gesture that Jesus did. And the sigh, what's that? Well, that's a sign of love, isn't it? A sign of pity. A sign of compassion. He feels sorry for this man. He sighs. He feels sorry for the mess that the world is in because of sin and the suffering that this man was in, and plenty of others too. And so he sighs. He connects with this man in this simple sign language of love. And then Jesus says a word. Ephphatha, I think if we try to split up those syllables in English, which isn't the easiest series of sounds to make or to hear at all, is it? Ephphatha, says Jesus to him. And we're told what it means is be opened. That was the moment then. Immediately his ears were opened. So the first word he ever heard was be opened. As Jesus started to say that word, Jesus, as we've been singing, nothing's impossible for him. And somehow in that moment, Jesus spoke to this man, be opened. And his ears were open. Whatever it was, whatever problem there was, whatever disability there was that was a block to hearing, Jesus says, be opened. And now his ears can hear, he can listen. His ears are working. And Jesus says, be opened to his mouth, to his lips and his tongue. And now this man can speak and talk and sing. This moment, this instant when Jesus changes everything. Jesus uses this simple sign language. And yet when we think through those gestures that Jesus is using, it's beautiful, isn't it? The way he connects with this man and changes him on the inside. A couple of little things just to think about. It's a pattern that we can follow. Here, Jesus' simple sign language reaches out to this man in need. Do we do it? Are we those who are the people of the risen King, as we were singing, first of all, who reach out to those in darkness? Are we those who are at work trying to connect with people? Maybe especially those who are disabled and disadvantaged, those who are picked on, those who are isolated, those who are alone. Do we stop to help? On a practical level, when we're around town, when we're popping into the supermarket, do we have our eyes open for those who are in need? Do we stop, or are we those who hurry on past, like those who weren't good neighbours to the man who was injured? Do we stop and try and connect with those who are lost? Do we do those things as a church? Try to connect with people. Try to reach out to those, as Jesus does to this poor man. Are we those who touch? Are we those who reach out? Who are ready to welcome somebody with a hug, maybe, or a shake of the hand, or whatever it is? Do we sigh? Are we compassionate? Do we care? When we see someone in distress, does it bother us? Does it move us? And think, oh, poor chap, or whoever it is. And we want to show love to them. Do we look up? Do we pray? There may be some things we can't fix. There may be a lot of things we can't fix. Do we look up? Do we look up to God in heaven and pray for people? Pray for those in need. And do we speak a word? Jesus spoke a miraculous word to him, but do we share words with people of those in need? And do we seek to connect to those around us? So that's the first thing. It's a pattern that we can follow. Second thing, it's a prophecy that is fulfilled. Mark uses a quite precise word. Back in verse 32, he talks about this man having an impediment in his speech. And then he talks about his tongue being loosed. And then it says it again in verse 37. He makes both the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. And he uses a very unusual word to talk about this man who has something wrong with his mouth, with his tongue, and so on. And the only other time this word is used is in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, in Isaiah 35, and verse 3 and 4, we say that we read this: strengthen the weak knees, make firm the feeble knees, say to those who are fearful hearted, be strong, do not fear, your God will come and save you. Verse 5, the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, and the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. That's the only other time in the Bible that that word is used. To talk of, here it's the mute, the tongue of the dumb, and it's this word of having something wrong with your tongue so you can't speak. And here Mark uses the exact same word that was used in the Greek translation of the Bible, which was probably the one that Mark used. And so he connects it with that, because this is a prophecy that is fulfilled. God would come and save us, Isaiah 35. And these are the signs to look for. When God comes to earth, this is what we should look for. Him opening the eyes of the blind, the ears of the deaf, healing the lame so they can leap like a deer, so that the tongue of the dumb can sing. And here Mark is connecting the dots for us, isn't he? And saying, this is Jesus, this is the Messiah. This is exactly what Isaiah talked about. And now it's happening in real life, right in front of our faces. And we see it happening to this man. At the end of our passage we read, he says, the people say, Jesus has done everything well. He's done everything. Everything Jesus does is amazing, they say. Last bit. It's a picture of a miracle that Jesus still does. Jesus says to this man, be opened. and his ears opened and his mouth is opened. And Jesus still does that miracle today of opening people. Here we sit in church this morning, and Jesus can speak that word, Ephatha, be opened. And Jesus can speak to anyone. And Jesus today can open ears to people who've never heard and never understood of him before. Jesus can open mouths today to help people to sing, to praise him who've never done it before. Jesus can say, be opened to hearts that have up until this point been closed and fenced off to him. Those words, be opened, so encapsulate so much, don't they, of the miraculous saving work that Jesus is still out doing today. Changing hearts, opening ears, opening minds, opening mouths, opening hearts to respond to him. We'll pause there. We're going to sing a song, and the one that automatically comes to mind, if you want to follow it in the hymn books, it's 556, here up on the screen, hopefully as well. Over 1,000 tongues to sing my great Redeemer's praise. And in one of the verses it has, that phrase is from Isaiah, of the lame leaping for joy and the dumb being able to speak and sing his praises. So let's sing together. There's a worksheet for the children, so they can pick one of those up and head back to their seats as well. Great. Let's stand and sing together. So head back to Mark 7, and we're going to look at the accounts then, the first one, but we're going to look at it second, as we think about this woman who came to Jesus. Both of these miracles actually happen in far away, in sort of the Gentile sort of areas on the edge of Israel. Does that map sort of roughly show up there? And so the sort of pinky bit in the middle is the area of Galilee around the sea there. That's where Jesus was before in the beginning of chapter 7. And there's this conflict with the Pharisees. You might remember from last week, the Pharisees come from Jerusalem. That's not quite on the map, but they come up north to Jesus in Galilee, and they start complaining about some of the things that Jesus and his disciples are doing. And it's after that that Jesus then heads away from Galilee and heads towards the coast. To right up there in the corner, you can see Syro-Phoenicia. And that's up on the coast, not really in the land, it was in the old land of Israel, but not in Jesus' time. So he moves up there to the coast, to the cities of Tyre and Sidon, to that area there. And then he skirts round, probably round the north side, and then comes down then to Decapolis, which is over here on our right-hand side of the map as you look at it, to Decapolis, again to another Gentile area. And the Decapolis meant the 10 cities, which were these 10 cities of Gentiles, and where they were there sort of on the eastern side of the land of Israel. And Jesus goes there, and it's quite striking, and it'll sort of make an impact on quite how we understand what's going on in the passage in a minute. It comes after this conflict with the Pharisees. They've been talking about the Pharisees understood there to be some things that were unclean, that made you dirty, that made you unacceptable to God. And Jesus says, no, it's not the outside things, it's just our hearts that make us unacceptable to God. But the Pharisees saw these things as being very outward things. There was food you could eat and couldn't eat. And yet in those verses that we looked at last week, it's sort of declared in the middle in verse 19 that Jesus said these things, thus saying that all foods were clean. And Jesus is kind of just putting in here the infrastructure for what's going to happen later on, when the gospel is going to go out from Jerusalem and Judea, and it's going to go out into these areas around Samaria and Decapolis and up to Tyre and Sidon, places like that, later on, where the gospel would go out in the end. It's interesting because after the Pharisees have talked about these things that are unclean, and their biggest problem was unclean people, that's how they saw it, and these Gentiles up north in Tyre and Sidon, the people who lived in the Decapolis, they were unclean people. And so it's very striking that after this conflict with the Pharisees, that Jesus leaves Galilee and goes there to the unclean people, or so people would label them. He goes there to these places of Tyre and Sidon. And so Jesus heads off to that area. He's going to bring cleansing to those who were outside of the people of God up until this point. And he goes there and he seems to, at first trying to keep it very quiet, he goes to a house. Not the foggiest idea where or whose that is. But he doesn't want it to be widely known. But he can't. He can't be hidden. And a woman, verse 25, whose daughter had an unclean spirit, heard about him and came and fell at his feet. So there must be some noise, some rumour of Jesus being in the area of Tyre and Sidon. And this woman comes to Jesus. And she comes and falls at his feet, we're told. She came and fell at Jesus' feet. And she begs him. She begs him to cast the demon out of her daughter. There's this daughter back home, some other town maybe, who has this unclean spirit, or a demon later on it's said, living in her. We thought of what life was like for the man who was deaf and mute. What must it have been like for this young daughter who had a demon living within her? Well, we're not told much about her case precisely. We've got other examples, haven't we, in Mark that we've looked at in other weeks. Sometimes an evil spirit would sort of throw them into convulsions. Sometimes they were unable to speak of themselves. And so on. Sometimes they would often sort of have sort of what seemed like quite hysterical outbursts and things like that. And just be, you know, but worse than sort of any sort of bodily problem, this was something that was inside. There was a demon that was influencing her in this horrible way. And here this lady comes to speak to Jesus. J.C. Ryle says this beautiful little phrase in one of his commentaries. He says, "As hopeless and desperate as things seemed for this little girl, she had a praying mother. And where there is a praying mother, there is always hope." That's a beautiful phrase, isn't it? For this girl, things were bleak indeed. Desperate. Hopeless. This poor young girl, indwelt by a demon. But she has a praying mother. And her mother comes to Jesus, asking for help and mercy. We mentioned this before. The daughter couldn't do it. The daughter couldn't do it for herself. The daughter wouldn't or couldn't come to Jesus. So her mum does it on her behalf. It's what we call intercession, when we pray for someone else. And here this is what this woman does. She doesn't come to ask for herself to be healed. She comes to ask Jesus to heal her daughter. She comes to intercede, to put herself in front of her daughter, to be the go-between there, between them. And we have actually four examples of this in the Bible, in the New Testament. Maybe you can remember some of the other ones. In John chapter 4, we have a nobleman, and he comes to plead for his son who is sick. And he comes to Jesus to plead for his son. In Mark chapter 5, not very long ago we were there, there's the man called Jairus, who comes to Jesus and who asked Jesus to help his daughter who is dying. And in Matthew chapter 8, I should say, there's a centurion who comes to ask Jesus to help his servant who is unwell. And then we have this one as well. We have these four examples there in the New Testament of people who came to Jesus not asking for help for themselves, but asking for help for somebody else whom they loved. Once it's a dad who's asking help for his son. Once it's a dad who's asking help for his daughter. This time it's a mum who's asking for help for her daughter. And there's one, a centurion, who's asking help for his servant, his friend, his employee, something along those lines, maybe a mixture of those things too. And that's a good reminder for us, isn't it? The power of intercessory prayer. There's a man, there's another commentary I read by Matthew Henry. He said this: "We can teach our children, we can point them to Jesus, we can show them God's ways, but we can't make them follow Christ." We can't give them a heart that loves God. Only Jesus can do that. There are some things we can do. We can point people to the Lord Jesus. We can speak to them about Jesus. But we can't make them follow Jesus. We can't do that miracle of opening their heart. And one of our jobs as mothers and fathers is to pray for our children, as we see the example here of this lady. And there are plenty of other situations we can do as we think of interceding and praying for others. And there's a picture in that, isn't there? This daughter had a demon, a very, very strong, powerful, quite a distinct situation that went on there. But there is some similarity, because all who do not know the Lord Jesus are under Satan's influence. And under his blindness that he brings, they don't know God. They might not be able to pray for themselves. They might have no inclination to seek after God. And so, like this mother, we come and pray for them. We come and pray for those who don't and can't pray for themselves. And we're told to encourage us, both these examples, and in the book of James, in James in chapter 5 and verse 16, we read, "Pray for one another that you may be healed, for the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much." It works. Prayer works. We're meant to pray for others, as we see here in this example. We see as well perseverance in prayer. This lady comes to Jesus, and at first, Jesus seems to discourage her, doesn't he? Verse 27, Jesus said, "Let the children be filled first, for it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." Jesus seems to put her off a little bit as she comes to him. In Matthew's version of this account, at first, when she comes to Jesus, Jesus is silent and says nothing at all. Then the disciples try and send her away, and she keeps coming back to Jesus. And then Jesus says this. And in Matthew as well, there's this phrase where Jesus says, "I came for the Jews first. I came for the children of Abraham, the children of Israel." The disciples try and send her away and so on. And there seems to be this discouragement for this poor lady. She comes to Jesus, but actually she seems to hit these obstacles. And it doesn't seem to be very easy and very simple at all. And her prayer at first seems to go unanswered. And she perhaps feels getting a bit of this sort of cold shoulder there in that place. But Jesus was doing these things to try and coax from her a greater faith, to make her persevere, to make her keep going, to express exactly what it is that she believed, and what it is that she was asking. And so she comes to Jesus again, and we have here this wonderful encouragement for us to persevere in prayer. And Jesus says this very funny little phrase, doesn't he? He says, "Let the children be filled first, for it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." Now, at first, that sounds pretty unkind, doesn't it? A pretty cruel thing, perhaps, for Jesus to say. And to refer to somebody as a dog, of course, is quite a probably a racist thing. That the Pharisees and scribes did do that. They would refer to the Gentiles as the dogs, and so on. But here Jesus uses a different word. Jesus calls, says, "and throw it to the little dogs." You could translate that, the little pets, the pet puppies. Jesus uses the same sort of word, but he deliberately sort of tones it down and uses a different word. He says, well, the children have to get fed first, then the pets are fed later. This is a typical scene that we have in our house. This is not as ours or dog, but Heidi, our pup, will come and sit underneath the table. And what Jesus is saying is, it's true, isn't it? And I can try this out on the children later on. But, you know, when it's time for dinner, we don't fill up the plates and put them on the floor and say to our dog, "Heidi, will you go first?" And then I'll say to my kids, "You can have the leftovers that Heidi leaves." You can think of what might happen if we were to do that. No, Jesus puts the food on, you know, we're going to do it properly, we're going to put the food on the table. Jesus says, "I've got to feed and care for the children of Abraham first. The children will come first. I was sent first to the Jews." And it does speak something of Jesus' mission. His mission largely was to the Jews. He only a couple of times, as we said, goes into this little bits of Gentile territory. Later on, the gospel would go out into all the world, but it had to start with going to the people of God to whom the promises came in the Old Testament. But here, even in these words, Jesus puts in this little hint. He doesn't call her a dog. He just talks about this sort of family situation of, well, we feed the children first, and it wouldn't be right to feed the pets first, and so on. But then we see what this lady does, lastly. Humility in prayer. The lady isn't put off by Jesus' statement, but responds to him in verse 28, "Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs under the table eat from the children's crumbs." There we see that example of humility in prayer. She doesn't mind the little analogy comparing her to the pet dog under the table. She says, no, Jesus, you're right. You should go to the people of Israel. They're the ones who you should go to first. I'm not one of them. I'm not one of the children. I'm just a little pet dog under the table, hoping for a few crumbs. And in our house, there's plenty of those. Plenty of bits that hit the floor and so on. That's what she says. There's the humility. I don't deserve anything. She's not coming badgering Jesus and saying she deserves it all. She says to Jesus, "I'm not asking for dinner, but can I just have a few crumbs? Just a little bit of your mercy? Just a little bit of your help? Some grace for me?" She comes humbly. She shows what it is, as we're told in Psalm 51, to come to God with a broken and contrite heart, doesn't she? She comes pleading for a little help. There may also be a reference to the crumbs, because it doesn't come that long after the feeding of the 5,000, which would have been a story that was well known, wouldn't it? And how 5,000 people were fed, but there were 12 basketfuls of crumbs, uses the same word. And it might be that she has heard of this. And when she says, "But there's plenty of crumbs left over, isn't there?" It might be the reference to that kind of miracle, that yes, go feed the 5,000, go speak to the people of Israel. But there's plenty of spare, isn't there? There's plenty of grace. There's plenty of help for me too. And so it is. There's the answer to prayer. Jesus says the word, and it is done, verse 29. "For this saying, go your way," Jesus says, "the demon has gone out of your daughter." In Matthew, we're told she is said to her of her great faith that she has shown. And it's done. Jesus says the word, "The demon has gone from your daughter." He's gone. It doesn't matter. The fact that it was a distance between them. There are two miracles in the Gospels when Jesus heals at a distance. One of them we've mentioned already, when the centurion comes asking for his servant who's unwell, and Jesus heals from a distance. Here's the other only example. And both those times, the centurion and this woman are the only two in the Gospels who are commended for having great faith. They come to plead for somebody else, and Jesus says the word and does it from a distance, and that doesn't matter. It didn't matter where Jesus was and where this daughter was. Jesus spoke the word. His power was extended. Doesn't matter how many miles it was. And the devil's power was gone. And we're told that she went home and found her daughter lying peacefully on her bed, no longer thrashing around with whatever demon it was before. And there again is a token of that miracle, isn't there, that Jesus does. The greatest miracle, the greatest thing we can pray for anyone, that Jesus would open hearts, as we're looking at with the other man, that Jesus would drive out Satan's influence. That's our desire, isn't it? And we come to pray for those. We come to pray for our children. We come to pray for our family. We come to pray for friends and colleagues and the like. For these two great miracles that Jesus still does today, and distance doesn't matter. Doesn't matter that Jesus isn't here physically for us to go and fall at his feet. He's up in heaven. Doesn't matter if it's thousands of miles away. He can speak the word, be opened, and a heart is opened. He can speak the word, the demon be gone, and he's gone. And so that should give us an encouragement to come and pray. And so as we think of these miracles, this example of prayer of this woman, to come and seek Jesus ourselves, to intercede in prayer, to persevere, to have that humility in prayer, longing for those gifts of God, those gifts of the Lord Jesus, who's not stingy in giving out his grace.